This is Infidel One. Offending Coyote Down. Offending Coyote Down.
Roger that.
Welcome to Trappin' Radio. We're proud, organic, free-range, wild fur farmers of North America.
Let me tell you a little story about how I was raised. Every day work, every day pray. God, family, friends, yeah, everybody sins. A winner never quits, and a quitter never wins. Help folks in need, don't fall for greed. A jealous man is weak, so think before you speak. If you love them, let them know. If you hate, let it go. Fast can be fun, but sometimes you need slow. God is all good, the devil is so real. So listen up, y'all, cause this is how I feel.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got none. Except for the good Lord up above. I answer to no one.
Now let's cover our sponsors. They do a lot to help support Trappin' Radio. So I'm asking you guys out there and gals to help support our sponsors as they keep Trappin' Radio on the air. First sponsors, Oki Cable and Trap Supply. Jeb's the owner of this. He's out of Oklahoma. Super guy. You'll not meet anybody nicer. It's somebody you're going to want to deal with. You can reach him at oktrapsupply.com. You can give Jeb a call at 918-429-4648. Not only does he do trap supply guys, he's a fur buyer, so if you're around the Oklahoma or surrounding states, give him a call with your fur. When you need stuff, give him a call and he'll get it out to you as soon as he can. Our second sponsor is F&T Fur Harvesters Trading Post. Everything you need for trapping, hunting with hounds, and predator calling. Guys, if you're into trapping fur, hunting fur, chasing fur with dogs, you're not going to be able to think of hardly anything that you can't get from F&T. You can reach them at fntpost.com. You can also give them a call at 989-727-8727. Whatever you want, F&T's got it. Wildlife Control Supplies, proven solutions for wildlife control, delivering value, expertise, and products to the wildlife individual. If you're in the ADC business, control business, even fur trapping, you need to look at these guys' website. Top-notch company, have everything you would want, even the odd stuff that ADC guys are looking for. You can reach them at wildlifecontrolsupplies.com. You can give them a call at 877-684-7262. International number is 860-844-0101. If you're a wildlife control professional, you need to have Wildlife Control Supplies as one of your favorites on your computer or your phone, because when you come across something that you need specialized equipment, Alan will get it right out to you. Now let's go trapping.
See, I'm a flag flying, Bible toting son of a gun. Yeah, I'm hell on the heart, just a rebel on the run. Scared, don't know it, fear, don't feel it. The truth is the light, sometimes you gotta fight. Good beats bad, right beats wrong. I'm a barroom preacher and this is my song. I'm climbing for the top, representing for the country. I'm the people's champ, right out to dead camp. Shotgun toter, Republican voter. Hank Jr. supporter, let's protect our border. To hell with anyone who don't believe in the USA. Cause this is what I say.
Welcome to Trapping Across America. This is your host, Clint Locklear. I think this is the week before Christmas. So ho, ho, ho. And hopefully Santa Claus fills you up full of all kind of little furry things in your socks over the fireplace. I hope y'all are having a good trapping season. Take some time, if you get so focused on your trapping this holiday, take some time to spend it with your family one way or another. Just trust me, it's worth it. And, really enjoy this time of year, because before long, and it depends where you're living at, I guess, here in the South, we do start trapping earlier, but our season doesn't really kick off till about now. I mean, that's when stuff starts getting primer, and that's when our animals start moving better, and the temperatures start feeling more consistently like trapping. I mean, I've got some pictures I'm probably going to post on Facebook where I was putting out some mink cage trap sets, and my wife was with me, and I wasn't paying attention, and she was taking pictures. And I have to admit, it looks kind of goofy. I'm sitting there in shorts and muck boots setting mink traps. It was about 55 degrees. I'm fat. It was hot. I wanted to wear shorts. That's what I did. So, but it did kind of surprise me when I saw the photo a little bit, because, you know, when you think of trapping, it's not exactly in shorts. Now, if you're in Minnesota or New York or Maine right now, please don't hate me for that. You know, it's just the difference of the worlds that we live in, and there's nothing really we can do about it. Now, before we get into the show tonight, I have been asked to make an announcement for the Idaho Trapping Association. They have a North American Fur Auction fur collection for January at the Napa Sale. And there's some things on here. They have three different locations, or I guess it's four. I'm reading this off their Facebook page. The Idaho Trapping Association will host four separate fur collection locations on December 13th. Because, I mean, I know Idaho is, you know, Alan Propes, every time he comes down here to film, he says, I live in the middle of nowhere. But Idaho, guys, is kind of really in the middle of nowhere. So if you're up there trapping, you got some of them good quality furs, make sure you get it to somewhere you can get top dollar. They're going to have one on December 13th and everything. Now, if I'm not exactly sure where all this is going to be, to be honest with you, but if you go to their Facebook, or I bet they have a website, I haven't looked it up, Idaho Trapping Association, you'll be able to find out when they have these sales, and because it's the December 13th. So if you're running hard and things, and you got some especially bobcats, I would make sure you had them up and running and at an earlier sale. And the reason for that is, guys, Russia is our major buyer of bobcats. Hands down, no question, that's where most of it goes. Now, if you're watching regular news and not kind of going down the rabbit holes and stuff that I live down when I'm looking at the news and things like that, you may not realize this. Russia is not in some type of financial crisis. Russia is collapsing like it did after the Cold War. Rubles fell like 49%. You know, just in the last 3 or 4 days, people are trying to get out of the ruble. Government's losing control, stuff like that. As that happens, I don't know what that's going to mean to the cat prices or the cat sales, because I'm sure in a country like that, wealthy, still wealthy, upper middle class is still upper middle class. They still want fur. I understand that totally. But it may cause some people to maybe be a little more cautious in their spending over there this year. So if you're in Idaho or anywhere for that matter, this would not be the year, I don't think, to hold on to those bobcats for the end of the year hero picture. If it was me and I could find a buyer, I'd be getting rid of them weekly just to see. And if the price does collapse on the bobcats, and it may not, I'm not saying it is because I don't know, but if all this causes people over there to be real cautious with their money and it kind of slaps the bobcat prices around a little bit, if you're selling up to that point and you start seeing a major downturn in it, well, then you just store those cats so things kind of straighten up. And that way you're not losing money on your production or the value of those cats. You know, what I've learned over the years when it comes to selling fur, the more volatile the market, I like to sell as in over a series in a season, not so much just at one time. I don't try to hold stuff because you're taking too much of a risk on your work. So if everything's going good and steady and the prices are increasing and, you know, countries aren't collapsing and you know, China's not in trouble and all this stuff that seems like it's going on, yeah, hold that stuff, because a lot of times especially that, you know, that February sale or that one right after that, the prices do spike and you can take advantage of it. But when things start kind of getting sideways a little bit, you're better off to take what you can get throughout the season and try to get your averages up a whole lot more and keep them that way than you are trying to hold and wait. Because there's certain years holding fur makes you money, and there's certain years selling fur makes you money. And I have a feeling like on the cats, this may be a year to sell as you go. That's just my personal opinion. You don't have to take it. I don't have any type of, you know, pipeline to some big cat fur buyer somewhere or anything like that. That's just me sitting back and kind of looking and thinking, maybe this is a year to sell as I go. So I just thought I'd throw that out there, and do with it what you will. I mean, really. I mean, it's your cats, it's your fur, it's your production. So do with it what you will. Now, I want, before we get into the meat of the show, which is going to be a lot about coyotes, I want to discuss something, and I'm not sure how to discuss this, really. And I'm kind of shocked, and I'm kind of bewildered, and I'm amazed that when people are in different stages in their life about understanding business and money and different things like that. And I said something last week that I got some emails about that I really didn't quite understand where they were coming from, and it kind of floored me in a way. Now, I've got this bait solution, which I still don't have on my store because I've been so busy doing orders and trying to get this mink stuff done and keeping up with the wholesale orders and stuff like that. It's still not on my site. I hope to goodness tonight or this weekend sometime I can get that up there on the Coon Whisper, the bait solution. I went on a thing last week where I explained what it was, how much you could save if you were buying over commercial bait and different things like that. And there was some, I think it boils down to a lack of understanding what the true cost of something is, that some guys misunderstood what I was saying. Now, I also sell a bait solution for coyote bait. And there again, that's not on my store because I've been too busy, but you can get it at F&T. And basically what it is, it's kind of the same principle. It's just not exaggerated as much because I've got to worry about trying to preserve the meat for you. But you take a gallon of your meat and you mix a pint of this solution in and let it sit for about 10 days and you'll have a commercial smelling bait. Now, if you go to buy gator bait from me, you know, you're talking $90, $100 for a gallon. Or for, I think that stuff's $19 a gallon, $19 a pint to make a gallon of bait. That's $19 worth of your own meat. And you can save that other $80 basically, or $70. That doesn't mean, guys, that if someone's selling commercial bait, that they're trying to rip you off in any way, or they're making some absorbent amount of profit on that. That's when you look at stuff that way, you're looking at it from a greed point of view or scarcity, and it's going to get you in, it's going to make you think things that just aren't true. And I'm going to point some of this stuff out to you. With the Coon bait solution that I've got, Coon Whisper, and you go buy a bag of fish pellets, there's 108 pints in a 40-pound bag, or at least there was in ours when I had Travis go through there. And you know, and you, the fish pellets are about 40, basically. No, that's not right. They're about 20, basically. The bait solution's 25. You can get enough bait solution in that pint to do that whole 108 pints. Now, where I think some of this confusion is coming from is what the bait solution is and what it does and what it doesn't do. And then what's the difference of guys that are selling pellet-type baits for the market? Now, one, when you think of that $45 to that other amount of money, if someone's putting that in pints, guys, That means they're going to have about 80 cents to a jar. So let's just say they've got $100 added on that to jars. The lids are going to be about 20 cents. So that's another $20. You're going to have about 20 cents in a label, 30, 40, depends on the volume that you're getting on the labels. So you're stacking this money up on that. Now, guys that are selling bait solution or fish pellets for market, ready to go year round, that's already made, is drastically different than what I'm selling in the bait solution. And I'm going to pick on somebody. He's a sponsor, and I don't think he'll mind me mentioning his name because it's a compliment, but I want to pick on somebody a little bit about the bait solution thing. So when you see different products coming out, don't automatically jump to the conclusion that someone's trying to get over on you one way or the other, because there's normally things involved that you don't think about. Now, who I'm going to pick on is Jeff Dunlap. Now, Jeff has got a smoky fish pellet bait that I'm not sure what he sells it for, but I can tell you one thing. I've smelled it at conventions now for about a year and a half. And of all the pellet baits I've ever smelled, his is the most complex and the most on point of one I've ever smelled. And I've even tried to duplicate it, and I can't duplicate it for my own use because it is really that good. Now, what's the difference between somebody like Jeff doing something like that? Now, before I get into what the difference is, so you understand when you're making purchasing power, fish pellets alone, yeah, I mean, that's not really doing much. Fish pellets with just a little bit of smell on there, I mean, you know, just throw some essential oils and put it in a jar. That's not really what I'm talking about. Or you mix some type of grain with them, or you do something like that. That's that, you know, our market in trapping, you've got a lot of guys that are really, really in depth on what they do because they want to give their customers the highest quality product that they can give, hands down. And when you do the highest quality product, you're not making the max amount of profit. I promise you that. You know, I've been playing around with what I consider so far to be the coolest mink lure. I don't think I can sell it. I don't think anybody's going to pay per ounce what it would take for me to make it. Now, I can cut the snot out of it, and I can change ingredients, and I can do stuff like that. But it's not going to be the same. So I've got to make that decision. Well, If I try to market that mink lure, is it even going to sell? Or is it better maybe just to give the formula out and let some guys try to get this stuff on their own and make it? I don't know. But when you do quality, it costs more money. Now, the stuff that Jeff sells, like I said, is point on. And I'll even say this unequivocally. His bait is better than my solution because I can't do in a pint jar what he's doing in his prepared bait. There's no way. He's probably, I would say, every bit of 20-15% better than what I'm doing. But for the market where I think the price point is and stuff like that, that's the best I can do. And a lot of his cost, or someone that's doing something like his cost, they're making sure that stuff doesn't freeze. They're making sure it has mold retardants. It is complex on the odors coming out of Jeff's bait. Mine is more simple. It's highly concentrated, but it doesn't do all those other things that somebody like that does. Now, saying that, if somebody's out there and just putting honey or maple syrup or field grade molasses on top of fish pellets, it's questionable on whether they should be charging very much money for it, in my opinion, because it's more of a hack on being a bait maker, in my opinion. But when you look at the cost of doing 108 with the expenses and the shipping and everything to get that stuff to your place, when you count the bottles, the lids, the foam liners, the time, the antifreeze, the everything that's going to keep that thing from molding, which if you don't know what you're doing, fish pellets will mold pretty quick because there's a lot of flour in it. Your costs are going to be tremendously higher per pint because you're buying the pint. See, what the difference of what I'm doing is I'm selling a solution that you got to bottle yourself. If you want to label it, you're going to have to label it yourself. It is not going to not freeze, but it's not going to be wet enough to not to where it's going to be wet either. It's just I'm enhancing the smell for you where someone else is making a bait for you. And that's a lot bigger difference from what I'm doing. And some of the emails, it was kind of, well, you know, like I've been taken advantage of. You have not been taken advantage of because what somebody like Jeff is doing, and I'm sure there's other ones out there, I just haven't smelled them. I mean, there's a lot of junk out there using fish pellets, and I'm sure there's some other people that are doing some really good things with it. I just personally hadn't smelled it. Jeff's is really, really high quality. And I guarantee you the cost to Jeff, and I haven't asked him, but the cost to Jeff for doing that is tremendously higher than what I'm doing because we've got two totally different products. Now, if he was just selling fish pellets, which some people do, which I'm amazed at, or they just throw some grain in there or put some molasses in there or some hokey thing like that, it'll catch coon, but it's not going to do what a really good DP bait should be doing. But I wanted to bring those things to the point because the dollar per dollar cost analysis between what I'm asking you to do when I just send you a bottle of my stuff and what somebody that puts together a serious bait that's ready to go that can store, because mine, if you mix it up and let it store for 2 or 3 months, it's going to fall apart. It's not designed for that. It's designed for you to mix it and go use it. So I don't have the cost involved to making sure it'll do all that type stuff. But I just wanted to bring that to the point because you have to understand you have value in many different ways when you're looking at buying something. And there's different costs that different people have on how they're doing it to make a judgment call on is the value there worth it or not. Some of the pellet stuff that's on the market, I can tell you the value is not there. It's a joke. Some of the stuff on the market could have been used with another base, and it's that good that the fish pellets probably are irrelevant to a point because all the other lure-making aspects to it are right on point to the 10th degree where it's not going to make any difference because you could almost just use the juice and stuff out of there and catch some stuff. But the fish pellets are used as a, you know, almost as a bulking agent or something. But the quality's there with the money being spent everywhere else. And I just want everybody, if you thought that when you heard that last week, you need to step back and think about the true cost of what different people are doing with different things. Now let's go ahead and get to, and I hope that makes sense to everybody, because it really bothered me, because I don't see other lure makers as competition. I really don't. You know, the pie, there's no size to the pie, so there's no need for us to, you know, be fighting over a slice of the pie or something like that. That's ridiculous. But at the same time, I just assumed that people understood when people do different things, they have different cost in it. Because what I'm giving you is kind of like a DIY type thing. He's giving you a commercially made product. And the value is very different that you've got to understand. A piece of plate metal that's cut out, that's say 7x7, it's got the value of maybe 40 cents. Now when Chip from Expand-A-Pan makes a bolt-on pan with that thing, the value changes drastically because of what he's done to do that. The value's there for what Chip's doing with Expand-A-Pan, but just to sell you a piece of that square piece of metal that's not been plasma cut, not been built, not been put on the jigs to make it bolt up to a new trap, the value different is very different there. It's kind of like the same base material, but the value's been added to charge more money. And that's kind of where I wanted you to understand where I was coming from. All righty, let's change gears a little bit and talk a little bit about trapping. We're going to talk about coyote trapping a little bit on some different aspects of it today that are just some pretty cool things, really. How do you use droppings when you're trapping? You know, there's all kind of different ways, and I'm never going to say that one is right or wrong. Everybody's got their own style. Everybody's got their own reasoning for doing what they're doing. There's three ways that I use them on a regular basis when it comes to coyotes that I think makes a difference. If you're doing something different, I'm not saying you're wrong. If you're doing something that's completely different, I'm sure you've got a reason for it. But just kind of think about what you're doing when you're using them, you know, because I know I don't use them as much as I used to. You know, when I first got back from Alaska, after church, me and Cindy would go out and we'd walk some of the timber country on the sandy roads, and we'd pick up droppings. I mean, that's what we did on Sunday afternoon. You know, that, I know that's kind of a strange thing to do, but I wanted all the droppings that I could get. And that's what we did kind of for entertainment. We didn't have any money, so we could walk. But I started using the droppings in different ways, and I found three ways that seemed to really help. Now, the first one, if I've got a road and there's coyote tracks that's going up and down it, you'll notice a lot of times, and you can watch your hunting dog do the same thing. He'll go from one side of that road to the other. And he'll do it consistently, whether what the temperature or the wind is doing. It's like a canine just has a better side of the road that looks better to him for whatever reason. And coyotes do the same thing. So you'll have certain sides of that road that they will go to. Now, there may be a trail coming on one that they're really not using that particular side. Now, we're only talking, you know, on a dirt road, pretty much the width of a car, a little bit more. So even if you set your set, you would still have it pretty much on location, you know. So this may be an over compensation of whatever. But I could see from the tracks when I was in sandy ground, and I've done this a lot in Texas, because it's always interesting to me to be able to watch what a coyote does in certain situations. So we've got a road, and the coyote tracks are not on the side that I want to put the set. And it could be a wind factor. It could be there's nothing but rock on the other side, or nothing but, you know, something like blackberries or honeysuckle that's just a pain in the butt to deal with. But that's where they're at, and I've always got my second reason for the location. It could be a trail. It could be a gap coming over a mountain somewhere. It could be in the bottom of a draw. It could be whatever. What I like to do with droppings is I use it as a way to stall a coyote. And by stalling a coyote, if their tracks are on the other side and I've got the trail or whatever I'm using for my secondary reason for having my set there, I can take those droppings and I can set those in the middle of the road, and you'll watch what the coyotes do. And they'll be coming down that road, and before they ever work the set, they're gonna check out those droppings. A lot of times they'll pee on them. Sometimes they'll go to the bathroom themselves. Sometimes they'll kind of circle them, but they'll come up and they'll check them out. What I've done by setting those droppings in the road, even though it's 6-8 feet away from my set, I've got the coyote stopped. I've got him off his trot and off his hunting mentality, and he stopped. And then once he stopped, I'm hoping that the wind or the visual or the lure or the bait or whatever I've done at that particular set is going to get that coyote's attention enough that he's going to go over and work that set. So this is really helpful a lot of times if you're in very open country, like you get up in the Midwest and you've got that one drainage ditch and it where they've had crops, and you've got 500 acre fields on one side, and those coyotes are going to be hunting that ditch. And they're going to be hunting it at about 4 to 6 miles an hour as they trot down through there. They're trying to get something to jump or move or something like that. And you can, even in that situation, about 4 to 5 feet off of that, I can set that dropping, and they're going to come in contact with that, and that'll stall most of them out. Once I get them stalled, I think I have a better opportunity for them to work their set. Because if you don't stop them, they're not going to, there's no way they're ever going to work your set. So that's one way that I use droppings. The other way is I use them for feet placement at sets. The first one that comes to mind that I use a lot when I'm doing mafia style sets, which is a blind set in a trail with two traps, the way that I learned it from O'Gorman, instead of trying to put a stick or something like that in between the traps or a jump stick or whatever, I will use where those, if I'm using coil springs, which I like to use on the mafia sets, I set them where the coyote's going between the jaws and the levers are almost touching. I'm talking, you know, well, a lot of times they are touching, but you know, they're just not overlapping each other. And then I'll put a small stick right where those two levers come in the trail where it's choked down. I will blend those in, and I can take my little stick up, and I can put my dropping right where that stick is at. So when the coyote's coming down, he's going to step over the dropping because nothing wants to step on crap. And he's going to be into the next trap, whichever direction he's coming. That's kind of the mafia thing, you know, no matter what he does, you know, there's, you got something he can't refuse kind of thing. And I use it that way. I also use it on my regular coyote sets if I want to make sure that a coyote stops, let's say a dirt hole, and I've got my trap 12, 14 inches back or wherever it is, wherever I think it needs to be on that particular set, I can set that dropping right in front of the jaws, and a lot of times the coyote will step right up to it, which will be inside your jaws of your trap, and investigate the trap that way. It's kind of a, it's like a line in the sand or something. I'm not sure exactly why they just don't step over it, but they seem to stall out in front of that dropping. I'm sure they're smelling it. You know, I personally do not like to add commercial urine to droppings. I think that that can tip some coyotes off because, you know, now you got a dropping that's got 45 different coyote smells on it from 45 different coyotes, and I do think that a coyote can definitely tell the difference on that. I don't want to use gland lure at a situation like that because I don't want him to be back off from it investigating the gland lure with that. So when I'm using it as a guide at the trap, or if I think that there's an open area that may give me problems, I can plunk down some droppings right there and keep him off of that right there. Now, you don't want to circle up your set or something with droppings because it's going to be too unnatural. But if you had two, if you had three approaches getting to your set and you could block two of them off with droppings and kind of put some dirt over, you know, just a light sifting to make them aged right there, I don't think you're going to hurt anything. But using them for to stop a coyote on top of your trap, I like that a lot. And I use that a lot. The other way I like using droppings is actually in the set itself. The set itself is a very simple and fast set. It can work really good any time of the year, but it seems like it really pays off more later in the year when the coyotes are more worried about what coyote is where and whose territory and who they belong to and different things like that. And it's such a fast set to put in if you choose your locations wisely with the ground conditions where you can blend a set in really quick. Like around here in the mountains, or if you're around somewhere that's got a lot of timber, you'll have a lot of areas, even in really rough ground with rocks and chert and red clay, because of the way the timber companies manage their land, there's a lot of erosion. And where that erosion filters out and slows down, you pretty much got sand. And you can put in, and you'll notice that coyotes like that soft dirt. And that's the type of places I really like using this dropping set, because I can go in, I can quickly put in a blended set very quickly, blend it in very easily, especially if I spread my blending out over 2 or 3 feet. And then about 10, 11 inches in front of that trap, up against the backing of something, I can put a big, nice, shiny dropping. And on top of that, I mean, underneath that dropping, not on top of it, I can put some fresh coyote or cat or fox glands. Now, fresh glands, I think, in this particular set, work a lot better than rotted down glands. Now, the ones that I make that are booty call for the coyotes and the cats, they're fresh. That means I take fresh glands and I don't let them rot down or taint. They smell like the animal, which is what a dropping actually smells like when it comes out through the glands of an animal. Now, there's a lot of guys that just the old-timey way of doing glands, and you're going to have to talk to whoever you buy your gland lures from to know, to make the decision if it's the right type of gland lure for this set or you really care. Are they rotted down? Are they fresh? And a lure maker should not have a problem telling you one way or the other. I mean, it's not a secret. They're either fresh or they're not. They're rotted down. You know, is there anything in there that's more of a curiosity type thing? A lure maker shouldn't have any trouble telling you that. Because a lot of gland lures, I don't use it in mine. I do use it in Yoke Dope, which is kind of a hyper gland lure, which does have some sexual stuff with there, but a lot of guys will make their fresh or their rotted gland lures and they'll put ingredients that will get a sexual response from a coyote in that. But it changes, to me, it totally changes what a fresh gland is doing. And you may get a different reaction. Because if you put a dirt hole set in and then you put in a dropping set, you'll see that the coyotes will approach the dropping a whole lot less skittish than they do any other type of set, because it's extremely natural. It's just like walking over and seeing who was there. I mean, there's nothing there. There's no food involved. There's no crazy Tonquins or anything like that's going to set them off that this is totally strange. And they walk up to that set and it's a lot more natural. And a lot of times they're just drive-bying them. You know, they'll just, you'll have to watch. When you're setting these things out on roads, if you're putting traps on them, if you're setting it on the edge of the road, this is kind of a down and dirty way to think of trap placement when you're just using droppings. The closer you are to the travel way, the more in line with the travel way the trap needs to be. So, for instance, if there's coyote tracks going down the side of a dirt road and I put the dropping pretty much in line with those tracks, my trap needs to be in line with the tracks and the dropping. If I'm moving out in the road or off towards the grass a little bit more, I need to angle that trap a little bit, because what happens with a coyote is he's coming up to check them out. If he's straight on, he's not going to circle it or go out anywhere to smell it. But if you've got it off, say, 6-8 inches from where he's going anyway, he'll have to veer off a little bit. But that's drastically different than thinking of a set the way that a human would think of a set, where you put a dropping on the side of the road, then directly in front of it you put your trap. Very different from what I'm saying. So, if it's in line with the tracks, the trap is in line with the tracks. If it's off, then you need to, like, in your middle eye, if an animal was going to walk up and veer over to it, that's the line that the trap needs to be in. Now, if you've got a road and you've got a lot of traffic and you know they're just going to run it over and you put it in between some brush or whatever and it's like a 90-degree angle to the road, well, then the trap should be in front of it, because that's pretty much how the animal is going to get into that, especially with some blocking. So you're going to have to play with that. And the best thing to do with that, and this is something you can do in the summer, you could take notes, you could do whatever, you can really get a grasp of this really quick, is take some droppings with nothing on them, go out to somewhere that you can see tracks, whether it be mud, sand, or snow, see where the coyote travel way is,
and then in different places put your scat, and then just come back in a few days and you'll see what I'm talking about. The closer to the travel way, the more in line the trap's going to be. The more out of the travel way, the more of straight ahead you get. And once you kind of see it in two or three different ways, what I'm saying makes perfect sense to you, and then you can go rocking and rolling and not really think about it anymore. That's three different ways that I use droppings personally, and I'm sure there's all kind of different ways. You know, I've seen a lot of guys, and I'm not saying this is wrong, where they put them on top of rocks and stuff like that, or on top of a piece of wood with a flat set, stuff. That's not natural, not for a coyote. And it stands out. Even a person that's not trapping is going to notice it, where they're probably not going to notice a dropping just on the side of the road, because it looks kind of man-made. And it looks like something that a person did. And when a person's doing something in nature, other people pay attention. And so do the coyotes. Now, that's just my personal opinion. If that's your set and you kill a bunch of coyotes with it, rock on with it, man. Don't worry about what I'm saying. But that's just my personal opinion there. Okay, I'm starting to get this a lot. Well, not a lot. I'm getting about three emails a week about this particular question. So I thought that I would put this out here. You know, I've got a landowner that let me trap. He's got cattle on there. The cattle are screwing with my sets. They're popping them off. Everything like that is just a pain in the butt. Is there anything you can do? Well, you can go look up one of Matt Jones' videos, and he's got a set where he digs straight down and the trap is below ground level. And I've never done that, so I don't know if that works or not. If Matt says it works, I believe him. So I do think there's got to be something to that. And it's basically like a post hole set with your lure and bait underneath the trap. And if the coyote wants to get down to the bait, he's got to get his front feet off in your hole. And a cow's not going to want to step down in the hole. At least I think that's the theory behind it. And I have no doubt that will work. I definitely think it'll work for gray fox. Now, what I normally do is first, I just try to... The first thing I want to do is make cattle uncomfortable working the set. And this could be as something as simple as, you know, you find some saplings that's really close to a location that gives you, you know, a couple of feet, kind of almost like a natural cubby with these saplings, and you can put the trap where you've got the small trees or whatever kind of guarding the trap. And the cows being big bodied and everything, they may not get in there and tear those trees up to actually smell it. They'll just kind of circle around it and sniff and pee and everything like that. But they may not actually get on your set. That seems to work very well. Another way that I found that I can deal with cattle in a lot of areas. Now, some farms, you're not going to have this option. But just kind of imagine with me, you've got a field, and there's coyote tracks on a road that's running down the center of the field. Now, the farmer takes care of his road, and over the years, it's kind of graded, and there's a little bit of elevation on one side. So you've got the road, which is pretty much flat, and then you've got a little bit of elevation. I don't know about angles. I've run it pretty steep and still caught coyotes. I don't want it to be really gentle sloping because I don't think it does anything. But what I'm doing is I'm putting the trap in the middle of that slope. So if you've got a flat road and then it kind of banks up and then it goes back up to the field where the road's been cut out, if you set your set, especially a dirt hole or a flat set, in the middle of that rise, the cows that want to smell it from the road, their feet will be in the road, and it's closer to their nose, and they can just lean over and smell it. So their feet don't have to get in, they don't get in there and tromp all over it like they would if it is on flat ground. Now, if a cow's on the upper side of this thing, and he's smelling, the set is a lot farther away, and eventually he's going to figure it out to go down to the road and get a better smell. And most of the time, those sets, they'll still get popped off every now and then, but it's not like something that happens, you know, every other day or something. And they're very practical as long as you use them. Like if And a lot of times you'll be on farms and you find a spoil pile where they pushed up dirt or something like that. You can put that set where your trap's going to be, you know, a couple of feet off of the level of the ground, and the cow's just not going to step up on that thing to smell your set. He'll just keep his feet on level ground, and they'll kind of pack up and do all that stuff that they're doing, but they're not going to screw your trap up. So setting them on the side of a bank, and coyotes have no trouble getting the groundhogs and badgers and squirrels and different animals like that that aren't on the level. You don't have to have your trap on the level. That's a man-made concept right there. That has nothing to do with nature. So if you've got them on the side, you can still pick those animals up pretty easily. Now, the third one I do in extreme situations, because it works 80% of the time, but cows can get ornery. There's a lot of stuff that we use in lures and baits that will get a cow's attention, and they're going to see if it's a food source. They're going to check it out. And when one goes over and checks it out, now all of them got to go check it out. And they get kind of a feeding frenzy going on. And if they ever pop one of your traps, now you've got like a whack-a-mole game with the cows. Now it's a fun thing for them to do because they're not going to catch themselves. But now they get this thing that pops out of the ground. And I swear to goodness, there's certain cows that they like that game. So if they see you putting in a set, you can watch them. They'll be off 100 yards. And they'll just be kind of looking at you, chewing some grass. And as soon as you drive off, look back. He heads right over where you're at. And he starts plunking that foot down until he fires that trap off. And you can almost see a little giddiness in him as, you know, he's looking around after he fires it off. He's not being mean to you. He's just being a cow that's bored to death. And now there's a game to play. And I think that's what happens. But in extreme situations, and I've had to do this a lot with on some of these deer ranches that I get, they have such a high population of deer that the deer can become an issue as far as firing your traps off. So we don't want to have fire traps. So I will find, and you got to get really creative with this. It could be a sapling next to a fence post, next to a stump. It could be just some trees. It could be a trail. It could be anything. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to find something with some structure. It's close to a cow travelway. And I'm going to put my set as normal. And I'm going to use that structure, and I'm going to take baling wire, regular, everyday, cheap baling wire that you get at the co-op or Tractor Supply, and about 2.5 feet off the ground, I'm going to run that around the outside of that structure, and I'm going to fence in my trap. But it's going to be below the level of a coyote's head. And then I'm going to go up above that about 8-10 inches, and I'm going to run a separate strand if it's for cows. Now, deer, you only have to run one. But if it's for cows, you want to run two. Because they're a lot bigger animal, and they're going to push on that wire. Most cows, when they see wire hanging in midair like that, they think of electric fence. And a lot of them won't mess with it. But a lot of them will, and they're curious about why there's a hole there and what's this funky smell coming out of it. So they'll get up, and if you can kind of use some trees or brush or whatever to give that illusion of an electric fence, and you keep it above the head of a coyote, it's not going to freak the coyote out. Now, if you make a set, and then you try to make the coyote like go through a hog wire fence to get to the set, he's probably not going to deal with it. But by having it over his head, he can just walk up to it as normal. But a cow, because it's taller, you're going to be hitting them in the top of the legs and the chest with that wire. And they've been trained, most cows anyway, have been trained that, you know, the wire's there to keep them in a certain position. And they'll pack up around it just like they always do. And every now and then they'll break the wire. That's just part of the game. But whether it's deer or cattle, and I'm having issues, a lot of times I'll go to that fencing system. And the coyotes don't seem to care, but it really keeps the animals out. And if you're in that particular situation right now, you're going to have to get creative with it. I don't think I would be beating in fence posts or anything like that, or rebar, to make these things. But, you know, you just follow the coyote tracks far enough to where they come up close to something that gives you a triangle or a square or a circle or whatever, and you can wrap that around, keep it above the coyote's head, and the coyote will still work the set. Now, once you catch the coyote's probably going to break the wire fighting the trap. You'll have to redo it, but at least you caught the animal. So that's how I deal with cattle. And there may be some better ways out there. And if y'all guys got some better ways, email it to me and I'll put it up on Wolfer Nation. I'd like to see what you're doing anyway, to see how you're getting away from that, because that is an issue. You know, if you start dealing with sheep and goats and different things, I haven't had to deal with that much, even though I think a deer is pretty much a goat, but they're so spooky that the wire usually keeps them out of my sets. If you're dealing with sheep and stuff like that, how do you keep them out? You know, if you've got a neat technique, just write me a Clint Wolfer Nation and I'll get it up on Wolfer Nation for you. Okay, I want to talk about a flat set. A flat set's pretty much anything that doesn't have a hole. If you've been trapping a while, that makes sense. If you're new to trapping and you've been dirt hole trapping, and then all of a sudden you start playing around with flat sets, you start hearing people give you all these different rules and regulations and when and why and this, that, and the other, and it seems kind of like more of a skilled type set. Well, it's not a skilled set per se, but it is a skilled set when it comes to blending in the trap. Because you want a flat set to look natural. You want to look like you've never been there. And then you want to give him an odor or a tiny feather or something like that to get his attention, but it's normally on something that's natural, like a clump of grass or, you know, an old stump or a fence post or a 1967 rotted down Chevelle in a farmer's field. I've used those for flat sets. They work fine. But it's something that's there, it's natural to that coyote, and you're going to blend the set in so you don't have a dirt pattern. You don't want to give them a sweet spot or nothing. And you're going to normally put lure on that attractant. And the only really rules that you want to have with that is you want to have it somewhere between ground level and where it's not above about 12 inches. Because a lot of studies have showed once you get that over 12 inches, a lot of coyotes will refuse it. So somewhere between 12 inches and ground level, you're wanting to put lure. Now, a lot of, especially newer trappers, are not going to know who I'm talking about. George Good was from Montana. I first heard of George Good from Craig O'Gorman when I was out there. And the cool thing about taking instruction from Craig is you only not took instruction from Craig, you took instruction from everybody that he took instruction from. So when he would show a flat set, he would show you how so-and-so would do it, and so-and-so would do it, and George Good would do it, and how he does it, and how Vernon Dorn does it, and you would learn all of these really cool old wolfers that's not in the mainstream. They don't have websites. Most of them are no longer with us. How they were catching so many coyotes, and he would kind of walk you through the evolution of what each one of them did and why. And then you'd have to kind of take that out and pick it. Now, one of the guys that I could tell he really looked up to that apparently was probably the master at flat sets was George Good. He was an old cowboy that did a lot of government trapping, but he could waylay coyotes with a flat set. And George Good he had a theory when it come to flat sets that was keep it natural. Make sure your trap is blended. But what made his stand out from a lot of different things that I've seen a lot of different, including me, a lot of times when I'm doing flat sets, is he had a theory on his grass clump that he would put like a curiosity lure, a little dab on say the far right side, a little bit of bait in the middle, and a little bit of gland lure on the left side. And those could be all mixed up. Or it could be a couple of different baits and a gland lure, or a couple of different call lure, gland lure, and a long distance call lure. But what he was doing is it looked like, from what I understood from Craig, is he would pick these grass clumps that were probably anywhere from 14 inches wide to no narrower than probably 6 or 7. and they'd always be right on the travel way of the coyote, or his one of his favorite places where they would be going to tanks out in the desert. And he would set up several of these around a tank off normally, you know, 100 yards, 150 yards away from that tank, but get them where they're coming to it before they get out in the open, before they start acting a little skittish. But by having a distance of 3 or 4 inches between those lures and having different lures at different sets, George Good thought that's the reason he did so good at his flat sets. So when a coyote would come up, and if he wasn't hungry, the bait didn't mean a lot, but maybe he wants to see if it's more of a older coyote, who the other coyote is because of the gland smell. Or if it's a younger coyote and he comes up, and he's more intrigued by strange odors, what's in the call lure, or the coyote lure, as we'd call it today, because it's got different ingredients and stuff in there. And if one was bone hungry, he'd want to get at the bait that would also be smeared in that clump. But they would be spread out with 2 or 3 inches in between them. And he thought a lot of times, because a coyote would circle these things, that it would cause them to circle it more to really get the curiosity fixed. So instead of having one lure, or just urine, or just a gland lure, or just a bait on a grass clump and with a trap in front of it, by having three, you know, he may come up behind it, and then to get to one smell, he's going to reach over, but to get his nose really close to the other cell, he's going to have to walk around to the front a little bit, or he's going to have to go back behind it and come in on the side than on the trail. And it gave him so much more foot traffic. And I've done a whole lot of these type George Good flat sets. Amazing when you do this. The issue, especially with a newer trapper by doing this, is most of the time you're starting out and you don't have enough lures. Because what George Good was doing is he would go to a tank in the middle of Montana desert or Wyoming. And then he would set out 8 or 10 of these things, like I said, 150 yards away from his tank. Well, he didn't want to have 4 lures or 5 lures and he just mixed them up all throughout that thing. He would use all these different lures. And, you know, he was a lure maker and he played a lot with M44s and stuff like that. So he was mixing the M44 lures up with that. And he was buying different lures and different things. But if you don't have the collection of lures to be able to pull that off on that type of scale, sometimes that can be an issue. And as a new trapper, you get in a habit of, let's say, you find out that bait A does really well in your area, and gland lure B does really good in your area, and lure C does really good in your area. You want to use those over and over and over again because you have confidence in them. Well, if you're on a 300-acre farm and you put out 20 sets and they've all got the same smells on there, it doesn't take coyotes very long to realize that something's up. But if you've got 3 or 4 different baits and 3 or 4 different gland lures, some with sexual enhancements in there and territorial enhancements in there, and then you've got, you know, different regular lures like Boss Dog and GH2 and Plenty Coyotes and different things like that, whatever it is, and you can mix those up over a trap line with a system like George Good, where he's using these 3 different smells at a flat set, you're probably amazed what you catch. It also catch fox and coon and everything else because you're giving them so many different things. And it's such a natural set, and none of these two sets will ever look alike. That's one thing about flat sets, which I think helps a lot with the coyotes, is if you do a dirt hole and you've got 1 or 2 dirt holes you do. You do like a Leggett's dirt hole and you do a Charlie Robbins dirt hole. And you repeat that over and over again. Well, the coyotes are not always going to be interested in every set you've got every night, even if they come across them. But then they go 500 yards down the road and it's the same thing. Then they go 500 yards down the road and it's the same thing. Well, it's got the same odor, it's got the same look. And then, you know, the coyote smelling you being there, it's feeling the pressure during the day as it's laying up because there's someone beating stakes in and stuff like that. It starts to get a little bit more on guard. by using a flat set system like George Good, you're using grass. All grass is going to look different. And you can use this under rocks. You can use it on, like I said, on stumps. You can use it on logs that fell out kind of across the road. It doesn't always have to be on the ends. It can be on the sides. It could be in brush, really thick brush. It could be in low grass, high grass. All of it's going to look different just because you're using something that's natural. But it's also going to smell different because you're going to be mixing up these lures all the time. Now, when you're doing these type of George Good flat sets, this is one time where you don't want to get in there and get a spoonful of lure and then a spoonful of bait and a spoonful of gland lure. Now, as a lure salesman, I wish you would, but as a trapper, I'm telling you, don't do it. You're going to have way too much stuff at a set because you're having three different lures within, you know, 18 inches. So the amount of lure that you're wanting to use on these type things is twice the size of a matchstick. And then the bait, you can go up to a spoonful of that bait because it's not going to have the punch of the lures like that. But you think of the volume of that together, that's a lot of volume, but they're different odors and they're kind of spread out a little bit. The only downside to using flat sets, until you kind of get a grasp on what the lures you're using is going to do, is sometimes you'll have coyotes start rolling on you. And then you're going to have to figure out which one of those lures is causing, or bait is causing that rolling. Because certain baits will work good in dirt holes, but they might not necessarily work good on flat sets because you get a massive rolling reaction to it. And it's just a natural thing. Rolling from a coyote, guys, does not mean it's a bad lure or bait. That is hogwash. That's an old myth. That nothing to do with nothing. It's just a response from some ingredient in there that particular coyote wants to wear like perfume. And a lot of the studies that's been done on coyote lures, believe it or not, the ones that catch the most will get a rolling response a lot of the time. So if you've got a lure that never gets a rolling response, I would almost bet you it's not a very good production style lure. So just saying. But when you're using these flat sets, if you start having a big problem with that, you got to figure out what in those three is causing it and replace it with something else where it's not so bad. You know, or you can take a T-bar or like a Wolf Fang stake drive or something. You know, it's got that, I guess it's half inch metal or 3/4 inch metal, and you can beat that in the ground with that particular lure that's causing the rolling and get it underground and don't let any of it hit the rim. And a lot of times that'll help you as far as the rolling goes like that. And there's no reason why you couldn't have three punch holes and do the same thing as this if you wanted to. That's not really necessary. It's a lot of extra work in my opinion. It's worse when you get some weather as far as rain because the little holes fill up. It can dry out a lot better if it's up in the air. You know, and another thing, just to mention for our last subject, when you're dealing with different lures, you've got to pay attention to what's going on your line. And you get in too big of a hot hurry, sometimes you're going to miss out some things that you need to know. Like I can tell you with my lures, Cat Collector, which is a very good flat set lure for coyotes, does not need to be re-lured for 30 days even in the desert. Because I've done it. I've taken lure from one set after 20 or 30 days and moved it and still caught stuff. And it smells the same. You know, just the way that it's made. Now at the same time, something like Paw Placer, because I've used it enough and I know this, depending on the climate, I can get 2 to 3 weeks out of it. Now, Yote Dope, because of what's in there, it only lasts about 10 to 12 days at a set before it dries completely up, and then I'll have to redo that. And the reason I'm telling you that, and all lures and baits have their own way that they handle, you know, but you're not going to know it if you don't pay attention to it. So if you're running these flat sets and you've got them out in the open, a lot of the the lure that's on the market by guys that really are just kind of getting started, even if they got a big name behind them. If they're getting started and they don't understand how to keep stuff from drying out, and there's a lot more than just glycerin, guys, a lot of times their stuff is shot its wad within the first 3 days. It may be the best catching stuff you've ever seen for those 3 days, but after that, it's pretty much useless. So it's going to be up to you to you know, test some of this stuff out. You know, do it to my lures too. You need to know this type stuff. So if you're going to be using Cat Collector for coyotes, which is a good lure for that, put some on a stick and stick it outside. Go out there and smell it every day. See how long it takes before that odor goes away. You know, my gland lure lasts me, I feel comfortable with just the gland lure for about 2 weeks, about 14 days. And then it starts breaking down a little bit from the weather and everything else. It'll still be there and maybe catch something into 3 weeks. But I can tell a difference after 2 weeks. But that's because I use these and I'm always checking them out and different things like that. So by using lures are going to be more out in the open, and a lure will dry up in the hole just the same. You need to, whatever brand it is that you feel comfortable with, you need to be testing those all the time to see what's going on with them. Now, the last thing before we close is I want to talk just a little bit. This is going to pertain to old and new trappers. And it's basically, what is the difference if you were to follow somebody that runs 20 or 30 traps and it doesn't have that much experience, which could be 3 or 4 years of trapping, and what's the difference between somebody that runs a lot of traps on a long line or does it professionally for a month or 2 weeks or whatever, and they've been doing it for years? What is the difference that you'll easily spot 9 times out of 10 between what we're going to call a professional and what we're going to call someone that's just really getting their feet under them? We'll call them a hobby trapper, even though they may be catching a lot of fur. What will be the difference between those two? And as you're going out trapping, and if you're wanting to get to where you're going to be setting more traps, are being more heavily income based on this on certain years when the market's there and things like that. If you kind of see you're leaning towards more of the hobby side, try to figure out ways to get more towards the professional side. Now, one of the biggest things that you'll notice straight off the bat from someone that sets a lot of traps, does it over a lot of miles and a lot of different types of terrain, is they're very smooth and fast in the way that they set. You know, in the seals, I think they say it's something like slow is smooth and smooth is fast. You know, they're not herky-jerky when they're doing stuff. So when you watch somebody, especially somebody like Randy Smith, put in a set, there's absolutely no wasted motion at all. He's got a way that he puts his sets in where it's smooth. So everything's kind of in its, it kind of rolls in a very smooth type thing. Now, someone that's just getting started trapping, that's not the way it is. And it's not going to be that way for several years. You don't have the muscle memory yet, but you can work on it. You're not going to have the sets down to where it's smooth and you don't have to go back to your truck and get this and you can't figure out where this is at in your bag and your lures are over on the four-wheeler and all that running back and forth and all that. When you see someone that sets a lot of traps over a lot of ground, you'll see that they're very smooth in all their actions. So I would be more concerned if I was trying to get to that smooth section, slow down and think about different ways to be smooth, different ways to pack your bag, different ways to lay your stuff out at a set, maybe the different order that you put your set in, different things to make it smoother. So as you're moving, every time that you're moving, something's getting done instead of trying to figure out where something goes. The second thing difference between a professional and more of a hobby trapper is the simplicity of the sets. simplicity of the sets is a pretty big one. Now, the theory behind it can be pretty freaking complicated, depending on what that person's doing. But the theory of the set is extremely simple to someone that sets a lot of traps. You've got guys that set so many traps, coyote trapping, that are more fox trapping, they still catch enough fox. But they're very smooth and fast and simple in doing that, and they get those sets out over and over and over and over and over again. And just a percentage-wise, they're going to catch enough fur to be happy. When someone first starts in trapping, even 3 or 4 years into it, sometimes 10 years into it, and I've talked to guys convention 30 years into it, you get wrapped up in every single article and video that you've seen. And you know, we got to make this look like this, and this is because the mouse is repelling off of the tree, and he's going to dig under here to go see the hobbits, and he's going to come up on this other side, and he's going to have a picnic, and then he's going to run back around, and we got to have these tunnels and the traps, and they got to be facing this way and that way, and all this. I mean, it's crazy. That's not the stuff that professionals do, I promise you. Most of them, when they're professionally trapping, like when I make bobcat sets, it's the same bobcat set every single time, unless I'm trying to learn something. I've got flat sets for coyotes, and I've got Charlie Robin dirt hole sets for coyotes. Those are the only two sets that I make if I'm really rocking and rolling for coyote numbers and I'm fur trapping. That's it. That way I've got the same equipment to do the same thing over and over again. And once you put out like 100 of them over a couple of days, and the third day, once you get your coffee and you're woke up, you can put the sets in a lot of times in just a couple of minutes. And then you get back to the truck and you're trying to realize, did I stake it? Did I put a pan cover on it? Did I bait it? Because it goes so smoothly, because I'm not trying to mix and max every single set that I do. Now, the way that I set when I'm doing a special lot of control work is I may take a minute when I get out of the truck looking at to see the approach that I'm wanting on that coyote. And then I'll adjust. So when I'm doing that type of trapping, where it's more holistic redneck trapping, they are all going to look different, but they're the same set. Just the ground around them is a little bit different. And I don't try to get too fancy when I'm trying to do that type stuff, because it's production. But it's your professional is going to be smooth, which can be learned. And it's just like this. You take somebody that, the four things all guys think they can do. All guys think they can start a fire. All guys think they're good in the sack. All guys think that they know how to shoot, and they all know how to drive. And very few guys are very good at any of them. But you take somebody that very rarely gets around a gun, or they grew up in a country and they've handled some pistols off and on, and it's not something they do all the time, and you put them with a holster and a 45 or whatever, 9mm, makes no difference. Take them to a range, someone that's grew up around guns, and tell them you're going to time them on 5 draws going on a 5-foot target. They're going to get hung up on the holster. They're going to miss the target. They're going to do all kind of stuff because they're in a hurry and they're jerky. Now, you take somebody that trains with a pistol at a target range on drawing smoothly and quickly, you'll see that person draws actually slower than the herky-jerky guy. But in the end, his bullets are going to be more on target, and they're going to be faster at the end of the time round. And you see that a lot when it comes to the trapping things. You know, the other thing that you'll notice with a professional and a hobby trapper is the lack of it's kind of like indecision from a hobby trapper when he comes up. You know, he sees a road crossing and he walks back and forth across the roads, and he's trying to figure out, you know, the absolutely best thing, and he's looking at this grass clump and that grass clump, and that's elevated and this is not elevated, and that dirt may not be easy to dig, and there's rocks over here, and he's walking back and forth. A lot of indecision. What you'll notice with someone that traps a lot is they don't have a lot of indecision. If you ride up with anybody, and I don't care who it is that's trapped for a long time, when they set that, they stop the truck or the four-wheeler, and they get out of that truck or four-wheeler, within 10 seconds, they let the ground tell them where the set's supposed to be. Their brain has done it enough where they're already thinking of coyote travel ways, or they're picking up on coyote scat or tracks in the wind. All that's happening in just a few seconds. And they normally go with their gut on the first place that stands out to them. And they don't do a lot of waffling and walking back and forth, really looking things over and stuff like that. It's more, they follow their gut. In a hobby trapper that's been trapping for a couple of years, most of the time, his gut's screaming at him to put the trap there. But then he uses the logical part of his brain and he starts questioning his gut. And then before it's over with, he's like a spastic person trying to figure out which belt to get, because they're a little bit different shades and stuff like that. It's kind of tormenting the trapper through the trapper. But someone that does it all the time, there's not a lot of indecision. Now, when you first start trapping, there will be some indecision. There's no way to get around that because you really don't know. But once you get some experience in you and you come up, listen to your gut. Because your brain is the most complicated computer that there is on the earth. And after you've been trapping for a little while, your brain picks on stuff that you can't even put into words yet. And when you pull up and you see this, whether it be this certain type of grass clump or that little bitty knoll or this trail and there's a log sitting right out in front of it, and you go, that's a place for the spot. Go put the trap there. Just go put the trap there. Watch what's happened. Your instincts, once you kind of sharpen them just a little bit, are pretty amazing. Now, the last thing, that this takes a little more patience and a little more time, and you got to be willing to back off your speed a little bit at the beginning, is a hobby trapper, most of the time, their sets can be seen from a helicopter. They're that unnatural. I mean, when I'm out in different places with competition, most of the time at 20 miles an hour in a truck or a four-wheeler, I can spot somebody's dirt hole and it stands out like a neon sign over it, or a flat set, or because the pattern's just, abusive looking or crude is a good way to put it. And it there's nothing natural about it. So what you're wanting to do to be able to get to where you're smooth, you're fast, you're not being indecisive, and you're getting results of someone that sets traps all the time, is you got to practice being natural. So when you're driving down the road or your competition's driving down the road and they see something, they're going to have to get out and see if it's a trap set. Because it looks like, if it's a dirt hole, an animal dug it. It doesn't have the perfect little spot over the trap. It doesn't have the perfectly round hole. It's not on the perfect angle. It's not with the perfect backing. There's not sticks back there trying to block it. It looks like a mouse or a squirrel or a chipmunk or a badger dug the hole and left a couple hours ago. And someone that's been trapping a long time that does natural sets, it's hard for the competition to really figure out what they're doing, because they're seeing their stuff, but they don't know that they're seeing their stuff. So if you're driving up on your sets and you're more along the hobby side of this right now, or what we're calling the hobby side of this, and you can instantly see your sets from a distance, you might want to rethink about what you're doing, because we're talking about coyotes right now. If they're standing out that much to a human that does not live in the woods 24 hours a day, and we're guests in the woods when we go out there, and it's looking unnatural to us, what do you think that's looking like to an animal? I'm not saying they will never catch, but you will never catch the amount that you should if you're using natural sets. So if you're on the hobby side of this, don't take offense to me saying that, or you're, whatever. if you find that you're, you know, you're being indecisive at sets and your sets are unnatural and you're running back and forth to the truck and stuff like that, work on those issues so when you get out of the truck, it's like one smooth thing. Because if you go trapping with me, I'm not sitting there jerking around and like my hair's on fire or my feet's in an ant bed and I got to get out there immediately. But my sets go in really quick because it's smooth and it's just way more productive towards the end of the day. Because when you're trying to be too fast and you don't have the smoothness with it, it actually takes you longer to put in the sets. And a lot of times, towards the end, you know you're taking too much time, then you get sloppy, and then that's where the unnatural part of the sets come in. And when we're talking about coyotes, you've got to have them natural. And if you're just running a few traps, I guess it doesn't matter. But to me, it's always one of these things in trapping. I'm trying to get just a little bit better, and I'm trying to get just a little bit better and different things like that to where it can speed up and flow better. So when I'm out in the woods and I'm doing my thing, it just seems to be more right with the world. And then at the end of the day, I'll have out more traps than I would the other way. So hopefully all that's not too confusing. It's just something I was thinking about, because I see some of these pictures on Facebook, you know, and a lot of them are brand new trappers, and my sets look the same way when I first started trapping. And I mean, they jump out at you, you know, like you've got the little dancing girl with lights on that you see on the back of the 18 wheelers, you know, on the mud flaps. I mean, they stand out just like that. There's nothing in nature that has ever looked like that. And that's something you need to stay away from or figure out a way to get away from. So guys, we're going to go ahead and close the show. I hope y'all are having an awesome trapping season. I hope y'all have an awesome Christmas. And I hope your truck's full of fur and your stockings on the fireplace are full of manly stuff. And I'll talk to y'all later. Bye.